Get started here. Good morning. My name is Robin Alexander, and I'm the chair of Cornet Pittsburgh. Thank you for joining us this morning for our Coffee with Cornet session with Alan and Sharif. I'd also like to extend a special welcome to the IFMA members who are joining us. This is our first co-hosted event with IFMA, so welcome to the IFMA folks that are out there on the line. Before we get started, I just have a few announcements. I'd like to start by thanking our Cornet sponsors, AE7, First National Bank, First National Insurance Agency, Desmond Architects, Civil and Environmental Consultants, Hannah Langholz Wilson Ellis, and Colliers International. Thank you to our sponsors. Without your support, we would not be able to put on these types of programs. We do have one more event coming up this year. We are going to be hosting a holiday-themed bingo or trivia. We're still figuring out which one it will be. So please stay tuned for a save the date in the next few weeks for us to get together and celebrate the end of the year. So now on to our program. This morning, we have David Vandervossen and David Price, both senior vice presidents at Allen and Sharif Engineering. And they're going to be talking with us about how MEP can be used to reduce COVID transmission. David Vandervossen is responsible for overseeing the Columbia and Salisbury offices and assists with corporate operations. He works closely with individual office leadership to ensure implementation of quality control measures, client service, profitability, and training of the team. David has worked on a diverse range of project types, including hospitals, medical, K-12, higher education, police, restaurant, recreational, and water and wastewater treatment facilities. David Price joined Allen and Sharif at their corporate headquarters in Maryland back in 1997 and led the effort to open up a Pittsburgh office. He's now the co-manager of the Pittsburgh office and manages the Pittsburgh Mechanical Group. David is responsible for the project management and design of mechanical systems and has also worked on a variety of projects, including high-rise, data center, mixed-use, student housing, senior living, a variety of residential products, healthcare, and industrial facilities. So David, I will hand it off to you. For the audience, if you do have questions throughout the presentation, please put those into the chat and we will do our best to get those answered throughout the presentation. And then David will also be taking questions at the end. So David, you can take it from here.
Hi, thanks a lot, Robin. So we're gonna be covering actionable steps using MEP to reduce transmission rates. And this is the abbreviated version. If you, at the end, decide you'd like us to present to your organization or a different group, by all means, reach out. And we have an hour long version of this that we would be happy to do. So we're gonna go over acknowledging that COVID-19 is primarily transmitted as an airborne virus. We'll review how MEP design can help reduce those risks, provide a base understanding of how we catch viruses, including COVID-19, and review actionable steps for reopening or long-term strategies for pathogen control. So we're gonna look at the three primary transmission methods of COVID-19, understand infectious dose and viral load. We're gonna look at short-term HVAC approaches to reduce transmission rates and long-term solutions, including air sanitization. The first thing we want to hit real quick is Legionella. It's kind of a side note to COVID-19, but these buildings have been sitting empty for about 6 months now. Legionella is the largest waterborne bacteria that we have issues with in the U.S. It grows at ambient temperatures in the water. So the buildings have been sitting empty. Anytime they're empty for more than a week, you're supposed to flush them. So this link goes over how to do that. And you really have to be careful, you know, even if you're bringing a building back online, if certain floors haven't been occupied or won't be occupied, then you need to flush those right before they're occupied. So that's a good note to, you know, we're seeing an uptick in cases there, so we got to keep an eye on that. And the reason this is, you know, this discussion today is important is 30% of our carriers are asymptomatic and never get tested, and 44% of transmissions are happening by asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic people. So we've got people coming into our buildings. We push enough people through our buildings. sooner or later we're going to have carriers in there. So we need to treat everyone coming through our buildings as if they have COVID-19, because to be honest, we don't know who does and who doesn't, even if we're doing temperature checks and things like that. There's three transmission methods, and it's important that we address each of the transmission methods, and each one we address differently. The first two are what, you know, historically have been being discussed and addressed in the, you know, up until the middle of the summer, then aerosols finally came on board. So fomite transmission is touching surfaces. So I cough on my hand, I touch a doorknob, someone comes through behind me, and then they touch their face. Droplets is close contact person to person. So we're standing too close to each other. I'm talking, I expel a droplet that either goes into your nose, your mouth, your ears, your eyes, something like that. And then aerosols is when those droplets become airborne and travel over longer distances. So for the fomite, again, this is one of the ones that everyone's used to dealing with. So this is where we get into touchless systems, hand washing, a lot of cleaning, things like this. Now, the CDC did put out in May 22nd that this isn't thought to be the main way the virus spreads. So if your main focus is on cleaning surfaces and all, you're kind of missing the real transmission methods. This is kind of the least likely way you're going to catch COVID-19. Now, we do have over here a chart that's kind of important to look at. So, you know, the different surfaces, how long COVID-19 lives on them. And then in the air, it lives up to 3 hours. So that's what we're going to be talking about a lot today. So droplets. So this is why you do the 6-foot spacing, the masks, the screens. Architects get into single directional travel on the stuff, orientation of desks so that people aren't face to face, room limits, how many people you're going to put in there. And that all goes back to a study that was done with SARS. And you've probably seen some more recent studies and all, but it's still the same numbers essentially. So that, you know, if you're talking, coughing, singing, all that kind of stuff, the 6 feet basically covers you for large and small droplets. If you sneeze, they go longer distances, but that's why you're wearing a mask in theory, you know, if you're closer. But for most of the droplet cases, you're going to be under that 6 feet. Now, what happens is once those droplets become small enough, they become droplet nuclei, and they'll become essentially the weight of the air. And we'll talk about that a little more in a second. And you'll see that 160 feet. So we'll talk about that. So the terminology is aerosols, virions, droplet nuclei, micro droplets. It's all the same thing. So it's basically what happens is if the when you're sitting there talking or just working at your desk, you're going to expel virus particles if you're the carrier, and they're going to be encapsulated in water and mucus. And so they're going to be large droplets and then become smaller droplets as that water starts to evaporate. If, and they'll start to fall out because they're heavier than the air. If they evaporate, and that water or mucus evaporates entirely before they hit a surface, they then become droplet nuclei or aerosols or whatever we want to call them. And they are essentially at that point, the same weight as the air, and they will travel around whatever volume space they are in. So that's that 160 feet on that previous study. Basically, that was the area of the study. So they traveled throughout that study zone. So this is what people are talking about when we're talking about traveling longer distances. It's basically that water and mucus has fallen off, the droplets are no longer hitting the table or desk or whatever it might be, and now they're going to carry throughout the space. This has been around the whole time, obviously. It's been acknowledged on the engineering side and the medical side for a while, but for whatever reason, WHO and the CDC have been slow to really push this as an issue. And there was a letter back in July, I think it was, 238 researchers wrote this open letter to WHO pointing out the super spreader events, that this is primarily where it was coming from. So basically, as you sit there and work, you're going to, you know, if you're just sitting at your desk by yourself, you're going to be expelling about 30 some odd virus particles per minute just working. If you talk, you sing, you exercise, whatever you do, the more activity you do, the higher that rate goes up. If you cough, it's a couple hundred thousand virus particles. If you sneeze, it's a couple hundred million virus particles. So it does go up when those items happen. Now, the key here is we have to understand infectious dose and viral load. So if I'm walking in the park, someone's running another way and they have the virus, unless they cough or sneeze right at me, I'm not going to catch that virus. They're expelling, you know, like you said, if they're just sitting still, 30 virus particles a minute. If they're exercising, it's probably a couple hundred. but in the time exposure I have, you know, passing another way, I can't get enough virus particles to catch the virus. So, you know, it's not I get 5 or 10 or 15 virus particles and I catch the virus. I have to get to a certain infectious dose level. Now, that dose level is not really determined. I've seen estimates between about 300 and 2,000, so they're kind of all over the place. There's a lot of hesitancy, or there's an efficacy question about doing actual studies on this, because basically you have to take a group of people, expose them to 100, 200, 300, all the different levels, and see who catches it. So that's a lot of, you know, ethical questions there about doing the official study on it. But anyway, it's more than 10, right? So we have to get to a certain infectious dose level. The estimates are somewhere between 300 and 2,000. Viral loads, the other important item to understand, is the more virus particles I bring into my body once I hit that infectious dose level. If I barely get to the infectious dose level, I'm going to get a very light case, minimal case of it. If I get 10 times, 20 times, 30 times the infectious dose level, I'm going to get a much more severe case of the virus. So the more virus particles I bring in, the more severe case I'm going to get. And this really goes to, when we look at this and study it and what we want to try and do, it really comes down to the exposure duration and the density of that exposure that you're getting. There's two case studies we're briefly going to look at that show the aerosols, that prove it out. The first one is March 10th. There was one carry out of the choir practice, and you know, it ended up with 52 new cases. And there was no physical contact, so it wasn't fomite. They weren't close enough for it to be droplets. And the singing both increased the amount of droplets, the virus going out of the person, and also the other people are breathing heavier, so they're bringing more virus in. So this was looked to be a super spreader event that was carried out by aerosols. Similarly, we have this South Korean call center, and we had 811 employees over three floors of a 19-story building. There's a bunch of residences and things like that in the building also. There's 94 cases on the same floor and three other cases that were still employees of this call center. So the other people in the building did not catch it. So it was what they looked at was the duration of the interaction. So if you were going up and down the elevator, you weren't exposed over a long enough period of time to catch the virus from the person. However, these people that were exposed throughout a day or multiple days, to that person did catch the virus, and again, it's all these blue seats up here. And that goes to that CDC is changing that their close contact item over 15 minutes. They're adding up, they're now looking at not necessarily 15 continuous minutes, but it can be 15 minutes spread out over the day or something like that. But again, this looked to be the duration of the interaction, which the HVAC system serving one area, so it was thought to be that this is likely aerosols also. So what we're going to try and do is we're going to try and reduce the number of virus particles in space, reduce the people's exposure below the infectious dose level, reduce the number of people that reach the infectious dose level, and try and do this by diluting, by filtering, killing off the viruses, and controlling the contaminant path. And if they do get to the infectious dose level, we want to reduce the viral load by having reduced the number of particles that they did bring in. So we got three actionable steps we're going to talk about today. There's three more we're really not going to get into because they're a much bigger stretch, a bigger lift, and they don't do nearly as much. So the first three are what is being recommended by ASHRAE and the CDC. So ASHRAE is the American Society of Heating and Refrigeration Engineers. And that looks at, that's the society that both Dave and I are members of, and HVAC throughout the world, throughout the U.S., it's the standards group for that. So we're going to start off with a kind of example project, and this doesn't matter if I've got a 20-story office building with an air handler per floor, or if I've got a small retail space or something like that that's got a little rooftop on it. I basically have the same sort of thing going on, and we've kind of demonstrated here with this little sample project. Most of our buildings, we're going to be starting off with a kind of a base level MERV 8 filter. And we're going to be, if it's designed and installed per codes, we're going to have 15% outdoor air coming in, which means we're going to be exhausting 15% of the air also. So I have my carrier over here on the right. In this case, he just happens to be standing under the return, but in reality, we don't know where he would be standing in the space. We will have some virus particles that float around the space and get to the other people in the space, but you know, eventually that air goes through this system. And typically most of this, our buildings, we're pushing all the air in the space through the system 4 to 6 times an hour. So in our base case, you know, where we are starting example of what our buildings are today, we're going to be running about 15% outdoor air. So we're going to exhaust 15% of the virus particles out, and then we're going to capture another 11% of those virus particles. So when we do that, we're going to be having a pass-through rate of roughly 75%, which means we're capturing a quarter of the virus particles every time we push the air through the system. So this is kind of our starting point, and from there we're going to, you know, start taking our steps. So our first step is we're going to try and dilute the indoor contaminants. All this big block of stuff here says is that over the years from 2006 to 2009 is when there was a code change and we reduced the amount of outdoor air in the buildings, basically to reduce energy usage. There are also, on energy usage, we have what's called occupancy control. It's in either a occupancy schedule, so that, hey, when the building opens up at 7 a.m., I go from zero ventilation outdoor air to whatever my setting is. In our case, it's 15%, and I just do a switch occupancy schedule, and then at the end of the day, it goes back to zero, so I save that energy at night. The other way we do occupancy control is we do what's called CO2, which is looking at the carbon dioxide that people are breathing out, and it kind of monitors that and then ramps up the outdoor air accordingly. So if I have a building, we take our sample building and it's only half occupied, instead of running 15% outdoor air when we have a CO2 controller, we're going to run roughly 7.5% outdoor air. So it's going to ramp up and down based on the number of people in the building. So ASHRAE and the CDC give us three recommendations out of the gate. Is the first one is to turn off our CO2 controllers and go straight to an occupancy schedule. So instead of coming into my building, and our larger buildings, more sophisticated buildings, newer buildings are all going to have these CO2 controllers, and they're trying to save that energy. Well, at this point in time, we really don't care nearly as much about the energy as we do the ventilation. So we're going to turn off those CO2 controllers. So instead of going, when I'm half occupied, to my 7.5%, I'm going to go straight to that 15% and get that full ventilation in there throughout the whole occupied period. So that's our first step. Our second step is going to be increase our outdoor levels to the maximum extent. Both ASHRAE and CDC say to the maximum extent we can and still maintain temperature in the space. So what we want to do is we're going to study our systems, look, see how much capacity we have. Every 1,000 CFM of outdoor air we add is roughly 5 tons of cooling. So we can't just add it, you know, to no end. At some point, we run out of capacity to do this. So we have to look at the capacity of the systems. We have to look at the temperatures throughout the day. At different temperatures, we're going to be able to handle a different amount of outdoor air. So ideally, we monitor outdoor air temperatures and we ramp that up and down, or we monitor the discharge temperature of our system and we ramp up and down the outdoor air accordingly. The third step we're going to do is we're going to look at longer occupied periods. ASHRAE and CDC differ on this. So ASHRAE says 2 hours prior, 2 hours after as a minimum. And then the CDC says to run it 24/7. If we go back to that first little chart, one of the first charts we looked at, the virus lives up to 3 hours in the air. So what we're recommending is you go 3 hours. So after 3 hours, either the virus has died off, it's inert, or it's fallen out of the air and it's on the surface and flushing the space isn't doing anything for us anyway. To run it 24/7 is kind of a bit of an energy hog. So we're going with the 3 hours prior, 3 hours after as our recommendation. We do get questions about what about cleaning staff, other stuff like that coming through our buildings. And so there are discussion points there to be had. If we're designing new buildings, there would be, you know, and your engineer could get into this a little bit more with you, airside versus waterside economizers, airside systems. Our larger buildings are going to have waterside systems. Our smaller buildings or single-story buildings are going to typically have airside systems, which allow us to go to 100% outdoor air. So that would be a benefit, you know, as we pick systems down the road. So if we apply this first actual step, again, we start off with our, you know, we have our MERV 8 filter, and now, as I say, on this particular day, it's 80 degrees, and I can handle 30% outdoor air. Again, we're going to, different days, like a day like today, we're probably going to do, I don't know, 70 to 60, 70% outdoor air. It's a nice cool day, we can really ramp it up. But if it's on an 80 degree day, we can only do 30% outdoor air. We push that through, capture another 11% with our MERV 8, and we end up with a 62.5% pass-through rate. So as you can see, as we ramp this up and down, we're gonna get different pass-through rates, but just doubling it right there, we dropped from 75 to 72, so we got an extra 13% capture rate, and we're doing that 4 to 6 times an hour. So we're starting to thin out the number of virus particles in the space. So again, we're gonna have to look at the capacity of the equipment. We don't wanna lose control of our temperature. We are gonna lose control of the humidity a little bit, but we don't wanna lose control of the temperature. If we're doing a new building, are we gonna increase the capacity to do this? We have installed costs, energy costs, different markets. Pittsburgh's not one of them, but some markets like DC require you to report your energy usage throughout the year, so that if you're buying or leasing a space, you have comparable numbers to check against. Most of our larger buildings are going to have a VAV system, which is a variable air volume. So we have a central air handler, and I've got my outdoor air to my central air handler. But now when my offices are satisfied, that VAV box is going to throttle back. And when we do that, it's great that we have outdoor air at our air handler, but we no longer have it in our spaces because that VAV box is trying to control temperature. It's throttling back. So we have to look at control methods that would push that outdoor air a little bit more. Now they're going to either affect energy or temperature in the space. So there are going to be some trade-offs that we do, but we want to try and look at those control scenarios to try and push more air to the space. If we have a building with operable windows, that's very effective. It's not as consistent or known numbers as it is that when we bounce outdoor air up, but it's still very effective. And that's something we want to look at, trying to maximize the time that we have windows open or doors open. So the next step we're going to look at is filtration rates or levels. So the first thing we did was we diluted it. Now the next step we're going to do is take out, and we're going to increase our filters, and we're going to try to filter out the contaminants. So again, we start with a typical MERV 8, and we're going to look at your system. We're going to look at the amount of ductwork on it, the size of the fans on it, how much static, how much strength it has to push past all this ductwork and the filters. As we increase those filter levels, it's going to increase the resistance across that filter and increase the static pressure, which is going to also eat up some horsepower and some energy. So we can't just arbitrarily do this, throw in a MERV 13, and just walk away because it may not work. If we increase it too much, we can run into issues where we've dropped our first goal, which was increased ventilation, because we might drop the fan way back. And we drop it far enough back, the unit might shut off on what's called high head pressure and things like that. So we got to be careful that we actually look and we don't exceed the unit's capacity. ASHRAE and CDC both recommend MERV 13. ASHRAE has a recommendation for schools actually at MERV 14. And they both say the same thing though. If you can't get to MERV 13, go as far as you can. So if you can only get to MERV 11, put that in. That's better than the MERV 8. It's not as good as MERV 13. But then if you have capacity and you can go farther, you can go to a 14 or 15, go ahead and do that because that's going to capture even more virus particles. And the reason they give us this MERV 13 goal is here's our MERV 8, 11. At 11% effective at capturing the virus particles. And then here's MERV 13, and we're going to capture 46% of the virus particles. So we're more than four times the capture rate going to a MERV 13. MERV 15 is up at 71, and most of the gain between 14 is not listed on here, but most of the gain is at that MERV 14. You see when we go from 15 to 16, it's only 5% we gain more. But most of it, so if you can get to 14, that's the biggest step, another big step in there too. So that's kind of what we want to do. Now at your house, you probably, if you got a spun fiberglass or whatever, that's probably just like a MERV 4, pleated start around a 6. And then, in hospitals, most of them are MERV 15. People ask us about the HEPA filters, but in hospital, it's not practical in most situations. In hospitals, even, they're only using the ICU and the labs and surgery spaces, places like that. Most of it's got a MERV for 15. There's the resistance across those is very large, and it's not practical to put in. The cost, the size, and the resistance kind of makes it not a not typical application. So if we apply our filters to our little example project again, we're still running our 30% outdoor air on that particular day. And again, because we're adding our solutions together, so we run our 30% outdoor air, so we're going to exhaust 30% of the virus particles right out of the gate, and then we're going to capture another 46% of what's left over. So that brings us down to a 38% pass-through rate. So we've gone from a 75 to a 38% pass-through rate. So now we're capturing 62% of the virus particles or exhausting them, and you know basically it's 2.5 times what we started with. And we're doing this 4 to 6 times an hour. So you can see we're really thinning out the virus particles. So these two steps are the steps that almost every building can employ today. They can go get someone to reprogram the outdoor air, check the temperatures, look at the capacities on the system, and they can also order filters, you know, again, look at the static on the system, see what we can get to. But it's things that really are just ordering a supply, making some control changes once you figure out how far you can go. And those two steps will really reduce the amount of virus particles in the space, which again will go towards infectious dose, how many people got to get to that level, getting people below that level, and then definitely reduces the viral load of the people that do get to the infectious dose level. So that's really what we're looking at, and this is the first two steps are really what we're pushing people to try and employ right out of the gate. So again, we want to reach a MERV 13. Our filter costs are going to be roughly double at a MERV 13 compared to a MERV 8. And we're also going to have to change them out more frequently because they're a better filter. They're going to capture more items. They're going to load up more frequently. Our recommendation is you go up there and you look at them once a month once you start doing this. And then you can figure out what your typical schedule is going to be, whether it's going to be every 2 or 3 months. We're not saying replace them every month. Replacing a filter when it's not loaded up is just spending money. Depending on our size of equipment, will depend on how big of a, how large or how high of a number of filter we're going to get. So our smaller equipment, there's not as much cushion in the fan sizing. They're sized much closer to that what's expected to be on them. So there's not a lot of fluff to be able to put in higher filters on them. But if we get into a 15 or 20 ton central station air handler serving a floor in a building, very likely we're going to be able to get to 13, 14, or 15 on our buildings. So that's what we're going to be looking at and something we have to consider. Leakage or bypass is a big issue. This happens to be one of our buildings, one of our spaces, and basically that's painter's tape. We've taped one filter to the next filter, and it's also taped at the end of the rack. A half-inch gap in a MERV 13 filter rack will basically derate that down to a MERV 8. So it's very important that these are installed properly, maintained, and we keep an eye on them. People will ask us about portable fan filter units. So here's one that's a little more architectural in nature. This is one that's for remediation companies. These will do about 500 CFM, and they have a HEPA filter in them. They're fairly loud. A lot of hospitals went through, and when they were doing their temporary COVID ICU rooms and things like that, isolation rooms, they put these in place. And you utilize them to help hit the short-term goal there. What we would tell you is we would recommend you start with your central equipment first. If we use this particular office here, this is a 10-ton unit. It serves about 3,500 square feet and it has 8,000 CFM. Now at that 8,000 CFM, which is cubic feet per minute, it's an airflow amount. We're going to be capturing 46%, so roughly half the virus particles with those filters. Now, if we go over here, this unit's going to be doing up to 500 CFM, and at 500 CFM, it's in the 60 decibel range, so it's fairly loud. And it's going to be capturing basically all the virus particles, 99.9% of virus particles. But because I'm handling so much more air on the central system, even though I'm only doing half the particles, I'm still going to capture 4 times more particles overall than I am with the little local unit. So we're going to recommend you do the central system first and then look at little hotspots and look at the more portable fan filter units for those hotspots. Costs on operations for this. This analysis was done during the summer by Servidyne for Energy Star. They put out a COVID seminar 2 hours prior, 2 hours after per the CDC is what they looked at. and 50% outdoor air, additional outdoor air, because they had to come up with a number that they use. And the closest market for Pittsburgh is this DC market, and that's 6 cents a kilowatt, or sorry, 6 cents a square foot per year. If we adjust it to our little example, and we have 3 hours prior, 3 hours after, and doubled outdoor air, we're looking at 11 cents a square foot, or basically $110 per 1,000 square feet. So there is, if it's 20,000 square foot floor, you got $2,000 over the year. So there's a little bit of cost to it. It's not insurmountable by any stretch to do these items for, overall pandemic control. We do anticipate that the codes are going to start changing to increase the amount of outdoor air. Some of the energy savings items that was done previously will probably be backed off. The extended hours will likely go away. And we do think that the MERV 13 will kind of become more industry norm, and people will start walking a little bit away from that MERV 8 filters as a standard. So the last item we're going to talk about is sanitization. So we're going to try to actively kill off pathogens in the airstream here. And this is kind of, once you get past the first two items, this is kind of gold standard, is going to some sort of air sanitization method. The most widely accepted technology is UVGI, so that's what we're going to talk about. It's an ultraviolet germicidal irradiation, and we have an upper room and an in-unit duct scenario. Now, there are several other technologies. The one that we're seeing a lot is bipolar ionization. Here's some issues with those, though. And what the CDC and ASHRAE both say, and this is kind of applies to this, the gamut, but really the bipolar is the one we're seeing the most of. What the CDC and ASHRAE says is they're not saying that it doesn't work. What they're saying is there's lack of peer-reviewed studies, large studies. So what happens here is UV has been around since 1910 for water, 1950s for air. So there's lots of studies. There's some double-blind studies where they test one floor with UV, one floor without UV, and they show that there's better health outcomes on the floor with UV and that there's no detrimental health issues that occur. All these other technologies, basically what they have is they have room samples, and they look and say, okay, we put in pathogen A, mold B, and virus C into there, and within X amount of time, it killed off 99.9% of it or whatever it might be. They don't have double-blind studies saying, okay, we put this in effect on one floor, and we didn't use another floor, and we had better health outcomes on the one floor. So again, ASHRAE and CDC are not saying that they don't work. They're just saying there's a lack of larger peer-reviewed studies on them at this point in time. So they're emerging technologies, basically what they say. So at this point, we're going to recommend you go with UVGI. If it doesn't work for your application, then we would look at some of those other technologies. So with the UVGI, basically what we're going to do is we're going to expose the virus particles to a UVC spectrum. And it's 254 nanometers is a low pressure mercury lamp that we're going to use, and it's going to break down the DNA, or in our case, an RNA for COVID-19, and it's going to break down the ladder rungs, which will keep it from reproducing. So it'll make it inert that way. There is a health risk associated with UVC. UVA and UVB give you the skin cancer and sunburns and things like that. UVC dies off at the upper level of dead skin cells, so that's not our problem. But the issue we do have is eye exposure will give you welder's flash. We want to protect our service personnel and our occupants from that. So the upper room, this happens to be a homeless shelter study that was done. Most of us have seen the upper room in emergency waiting rooms. It looks like a blue bug light. So upper room, we install it above 7 feet. It's got louvers on it to keep it up high. It's a fairly low intensity lamp because we're looking at longer exposure times because the air is moving slower. So in a high density, high risk space, that might be something we want to look at. If we want to look at larger systems treating whole buildings, it's a little easier to do it in unit or in duct. Now the air velocity is a lot higher, so we're going to have to go to a more intense lamp. We are also going to have to watch the materials inside the unit or inside the ductwork to make sure they're UV stable. Our insulation, our plastics, our wiring, the belts, things like that aren't UV stable, and they'll start to break down over time. So we have to make sure that they're either encapsulated or moved out of the area. So we're going to size over what's called single pass. And with single pass, you're basically going to kill off all the, your goal is to kill all the viruses off one pass through this unit. So when we do that, we're going to end up with a less than 1% pass-through rate coming into our space. We're still going to have virus particles that are going to migrate from our carrier across the space before they go into the system. But 4 to 6 times an hour, we're going to be capturing all this air and pushing through our system and cleaning it out entirely. That's going to enable us to take that 30% out there air we had before and reduce it back down to 15% to our code levels, unless we want to do a belts and suspenders type approach. But for the most part, the people that are both, you know, we have it in at least 2 of our buildings. And what we're doing, since we're owner and operators or occupants, is we're reducing that outdoor back down to the code levels because everything's being handled by the UV. We're still keeping the MERV 13 filters in. That'll help capture the dead virus particles. It'll help keep the dust off the lamps. The lamps are what are doing the work, so we want to try and keep them clean. So that's kind of how we're approaching it. That's what we're seeing with other operators and engineers and stuff. Cost on this, the upper room is roughly $1,000 to $2,000 each unit installed. Our air handler, you know, if we do it in unit or in duct, we're looking at roughly between 50 cents and a buck a square foot. The costs have crept a little bit, you know, a little supply and demand going on. We do have to look at bulb replacements every year and a half, if they're run 24/7. What we've done is we put them either on a switch that, you know, with the main light that operates that space, or we have time clocks, things like that, that we're looking at. So what we're going to, you know, to summarize, what we're going to recommend to you is, you know, if you're either operating already or if you're looking at reopening, get your landlord, your building engineer, you know, good building engineer and landlord, a cooperative landlord, very helpful here. You get your professionals, your architecture engineers on board. Look at the immediate items you can do, the ventilation, the filtration, flow, you know, walking patterns through the item, through space, things like that, room limits. You know, execute those items, make sure you get the set points right. The filters, we've seen up to 6 weeks on getting the filters, so keep an eye on that. Then look at that long-term plan, which you might be doing at the same time. Is it UVGI? Are you going to go to a bipolar ionization? Which is the right long-term solution for you? Are you going to do other upgrades to increase the ventilation or filtration? Can your fans not handle the larger filters? Do you need to look at how you're going to handle that part? Do those long-term set points. You know, and this is going to there's a little more construction going on here, so you got to get your budgets and financing, get scheduled, get the contractor online. And we might recommend at the end of it, depending on how many changes have been made to the system, that you commission it to make sure it's doing really what you intended it to do. If you've already opened, you can still implement these items. It's not a one-size-fits-all. Make sure, you know, it's not because, hey, Dave and Dave said put in MERV 13, we're going to go throw in MERV 13. You put in a filter that's bigger than your unit can handle, you're going to have other problems. So make sure you kind of study that out. Look for solutions that are out there on the web for your facility type. Grocery stores, for example, I think it was Kroger put out their approach. It's a 59-page manual that they put out on the internet. A lot of it's marketing-based, but there's still a lot of good material in there, and they're not by far the only ones. So you can look at different industry leaders to see what they've been doing. And beware the snake oil stuff. You can go on Amazon or eBay right now and buy 5 million different little handheld UV lights. You're not going to solve your problem with a 50 buck UV light, and you could actually cause more health issues than it's worth. So you want to safeguard your business and, you know, your clients' businesses from being the next little epicenter. You don't want to get them reopened and then suddenly they have a problem and they have to shut back down again. So that is our abbreviated version of our seminar. So we'll take some questions.
There's a question in the chat, Dave. It says, if your building has MERV 11, does it make sense to add some standalone small air purifiers in conference room space or multi-staff areas like the mailroom? HEPA air purifiers, conference room, staff wear masks and physical distance.
Yeah, so what we've done some reports and some some studies and reports on some buildings. So if your equipment can only get to MERV 11, the first step is to look and see if it can't go farther. If it can go farther, push it farther, or look at an air sanitization on that central equipment. Beyond that, then, yeah, you might want to look at localized units. One of the things to keep an eye out for is one of the buildings we were dealing with had a central system, and then it has little perimeter fan coil units. So it's getting very little air from that central equipment, and then the perimeter offices and conference rooms and stuff are basically just being handled by that little piece of equipment. So then, yeah, we did look at, okay, can we put in, and I wouldn't go with name brands like Dyson and stuff like that. You're paying for that brand quite a bit. And you want to look at the amount of air that's going through the HEPA filter. And so there are some manufacturers out there, and you want to look at least two air changes. You want to take that whole volume of that space and push it through that filter at least twice an hour. So that's what you want to look at. And I would keep an eye on the sound levels, because a lot of those will do about 500, even the ones that are meant from the space. But when we checked out at 500, they were 65, 66 decibels, which is probably more than you're going to want in an office. So you're going to have to run them at the medium speed, so it'll be a lot quieter.
And then there's two other questions in here in the chat, both from JD. The first one is, what is the lead time for many of these adjustments? Do you think that it would be weeks or months? And then he asked, do you find building owner operators delaying work like this until they have a concrete return to the office date?
So the filters, start with the filters. We've seen the filters bounce back and forth. I think they're starting to come back in line again. We had some 4-inch filters that took us about 6 weeks to get. We had some 2-inch filters that took us, I'm sorry, it's the other way around. The 4-inch filters took us about 2 weeks, and then the 2-inch filters took us about 6 weeks when we, you know, did it. That was back in May timeframe. Manufacturers have had to kind of switch towards away from the 8s to the 13s and things like that. So I think that's gotten better. The UV, we have seen some issues. Those manufacturers are having to ramp up quite a bit from what they were doing. So that has been some lead times. We've been seeing around 2 months on that. The bipolar has been a little quicker. Dave, I don't know what you've been seeing on your end.
In our market, it's the same turnaround times. It's more of the UV stuff, as you said. It's if they can get a hold of it, it works. Depending on what they have to do to implement it, that's the other side of it. But the next part of that question was, do we find that the building owner and operators are delaying the work until they have a concrete return? Early on, we had a lot of talk about it as far as the filters, because that was usually the easiest thing for a lot of them to do. They would bump that up to what they could do. We evaluated a couple of the buildings in town here in Pittsburgh, and, none of them have any of the UV lighting, but they were all looking to do that. And the goal here is to get themselves ahead of the game. So that when their tenants are coming back, it's, they feel comfortable. Look what we've implemented.
We had one client we worked for. They're in the health industry, and they were in DC, and in the long run, they're looking for a 200,000 square foot space. Right now, they're kind of spread out through several spaces. And the one landlord knew that they didn't have an option for them in the long run and was really dragging their feet. The other landlord knew that they had some options and was being very proactive, was putting in the filters, was putting in UV, was putting in lots of stuff. Some of the things we've seen is some of the companies are basically out there writing up lots of great stuff, but then where they have to take the steps that really have some money and some steps in there in terms of the HVAC, they're dragging their feet a little bit. And then others, they don't have as much, nearly as nice of a write-up on what they, all the great things they've done, but they've actually done the better steps. And we've also had clients or companies that are looking to develop buildings, and they're trying to look at what's going to set them apart in terms of public safety moving forward, so that they can get the next group of tenants coming into the buildings, that they're going to be the ones that win the tenants.
Great, yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Hey, Dave, why don't you address Richard's question concerning the higher MERV rating? Before you do that, Michelle asked a question. Is 225 CFM for an air purifier room unit acceptable? The answer to that question, of course, as the typical engineer, I'm going to ask you a question. It could be. All I need you to do is you can type it or tell me how big is the room and what is the ceiling height, because it's all dependent on your air changes. 220 CFM in a, I'm going to say in a multi-purpose room that's 3,000 square feet isn't going to do anything. But if this is for a small room, you might have a big impact. I was just waiting for maybe you to respond.
Yeah. All right, so the, I had to stop sharing so I could see the chat.
Oh, the chat, okay.
Yeah. So increasing the higher MERV rating, it's not a bad idea to clean the duct and things like that. The longest time frame, but it's not really needed in terms of COVID, because the longest time frame that we see living on any surfaces is about 4 or 5 days. We've seen it in a couple studies. So if the building's been empty for months, there's no live COVID in there. So once you get the filters in there, you're going to be capturing. Now, that being said, depending on that dust gets knocked loose down the road, you're just going to clog up those filters that much sooner. So, it doesn't hurt to clean it, but it's definitely not required in terms of what we're looking at here.
All right, I answered.
And again, what's that?
I answered, Michelle, just so you know. I typed it in for everybody to read while you're doing
Thank
that.
You. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, basically you want to try and hit at least 2 air changes for those small room units. So you just got to do the volume. And again, I would be careful, like Dyson, that little hoop thing that they have, they only list the CFM, the induced airflow, which is not the airflow that's going through the filter.
No.
The airflow going through the filter is only like 40 CFM, and you really have to, you got to go through all sorts of hoops to figure out how much air that is. because Dyson would not, Dave, I called Dyson 3 times. They never answered me. I had to go find a study that says they induced 9 times the airflow with that thing, and then back the math out to figure out how much is going through the HEPA filter. So I would not recommend the Dyson one. There are some square ones that are probably 18-inch squares by 20 inches tall or something or other, and they have a drop-in filter. They'll do 500-ish CFM and then run them at kind of half speed, and those are about $600. And that's a viable option for most office applications that's, compared to the same price for at 40 CFM.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions we can help with? Again, if you have a group that you want to present to or you have other questions, feel free to reach out to Dave or I. I'm assuming our contact info has been passed out somehow.
Yep.
Yeah, what we can do after the call is distribute the materials, and then we'll share your contact information with everybody who registered, if that works.
Okay.
Last call for questions. Okay. Well, David, thank you so much for your time and sharing your expertise with us this morning. This was a great session. I certainly learned a lot. This is way more complicated than I thought it was. So thank you for the insight, and we really appreciate you spending the time with us, and thanks to everybody who joined. And like I said, we'll follow up with a recording of the session and the materials and your contact info.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add that, I mean, I recognize a lot of the names on the list here. You know, as you all know, if you have a question, just email Paul or I, and we'll get to you. We'll take care of you. You know, I don't mind answering questions. Usually ends up in work some point, right? So, anyway, everybody stay safe out there.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Bye.